Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Thanks so much for joining us on the program. We come your way every Saturday from 3 to 4 p.m. Pacific time. We're a rebroadcast on A2Zen.fm, and then we are archived. I actually do the archiving, so I archive the programs on my website at richarddugan.com, the radio shows page. So lots of opportunities for you to hear the program. Check the local listings, if you will, for A2Zen.fm as to when the program is a rebroadcast there, because they do it more than once during a seven-day period, which is really, I am greatly appreciative of that. Well, it's good to have you on board. It's nice to be with you here on the program. Because today we're going to be delving into a little bit of, I think that the general topic we might say is self-worth, maybe even using the term self-esteem, which, you know, I know a lot of people have some issues regarding the whole issue of self-esteem. But the reality is that we have a value, that we are important, if not to our society, at the very least, we are important to ourselves and what we do. And I was just having a conversation just recently with a friend of mine, and we talked about like awards. In almost every industry, in almost every work environment, even if it's sports, especially if it's sports, there are awards that will be handed out. Sometimes it'll be because of your longevity at a particular place. Other times it'll be for the kind of work that you do. And I often thought, you know, I technically only really have one award that was given to me by a programmer. I was greatly appreciative of that award. It was very nice of them to do that. But in terms of, say, national recognition or regional, for that matter, never done that because I've never submitted anything, which is part of the process. And so I do this because I love doing it. It's a joy to do. It's fun to meet new and interesting people and find out where they're coming from, like our guest today, who is going to talk to us about her latest work. Her name is Donna Hennis, and she's the author of The Queen of Myself, and it's Stepping into Sovereignty in Midlife. And I want to welcome you to our program. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Now, in terms of some, I'd like to start out by defining terms. And it sounds to me like your book is geared primarily, predominantly towards women, but I don't think it's exclusively. But in terms of defining the starting point of terms, what can you tell us about sovereignty? What does that mean in this context?
It means being the boss of yourself.
Aha! There you go.
Envisioning and enacting your life according to your own personal purpose and passions and power, and to really just that, take ownership of yourself and your life and responsibility for yourself and your life.
Hmm. And midlife obviously can be defined pretty much by wherever you deem midlife is. I have a great grandmother who lived to be 100, and in her early 90s, I was telling people I was going to outlive her. And the longer she lived, I said, she's making it really, really hard. So I'm just into the second half of my life in my early 50s. And I've got a long way to go. And who knows, maybe as I move forward and technology moves forward, we could live longer than that. You know, I'm not sure how I feel about that right now. I remember asking my father when he turned 70 how he felt about it. He says, well, I didn't expect to live this long, but I'm glad I'm here. And he's still going strong at 82. So that's kind of nice. But let's talk a little bit about this whole business in regards to, I kind of like to get to the root, if you will, the cause of all of this, in terms of wanting other people to gain their personal power and get back to the business, or even get to the business of living their lives, as we like to say many times through different venues, on purpose, finding their life's purpose. So why do you care about anybody else becoming? I mean, can't there only be one queen of the kingdom?
Well, that's the defining word of the kingdom. Maybe there can be one king of the kingdom, But no, this idea of empowerment is not about power over, which is how our culture defines power, is power over and power by manipulation and force and so on. And the kind of power I'm talking about is empowerment, the power that's within each one of us and that comes up. And my power doesn't take away from your power. My power is my power and your power is your power. And I like to think that there's a throne and a crown for each one of us. And that's how I want to think about power, is the power of ourself, so that we can, once we feel empowered and own our life, then to join with others who are also empowered and make some changes in this world.
Hmm. Well, I'm very interested in all of this because, and I'm sure this is may have also been the impetus for you as well, because of some of the things that, of course, went on in my own life. We all have our own stories to tell, as I have certainly learned over the years, and that those stories are extremely important from the standpoint of understanding who we are and why we are where we are today. But I find it interesting the way, and I haven't even gotten inside the book yet. I'm still looking at the cover because you have divided this up, interestingly, the queen of myself, but not the one word, myself. It's two separate words. Tell me what you mean by self.
Self, I'm using the Jungian concept of self, and that each one of us has four parts to ourselves, or four compartments to our being. One is the mental aspect of ourselves. One is the emotional aspect of ourselves. One is the physical, material side of us. And the other one is the spiritual side. And we all have all these sides. And if each person that we knew made a list from one to four of the parts of themselves that were most developed or most used, we'd all have different lists. But the goal is to put all those four parts together in some kind of a balanced way so that we can be whole and holistic people.
I'm aware of a tradition that exists in some cultures, not in the U.S. culture, not in the North American culture as much, unless it's sort of hidden away or buried away. And that is the progression, if you will. And I'm going to focus primarily on women right now, that as they grow older, as they become wiser, as they are there to help and support and nurture, as most women do from that motherly perspective, their families, their community, and so forth, they are almost venerated. In the United States, we don't have that. We don't honor that. Now, there's a term that's used, and I've actually asked some women about this term, and they understand what it means, but they don't like the word because of some of the other connotations. I'm going to use the word anyway, because it is actually a term of reverence, of endearment. It is a title that is respectful, not demeaning in any way, shape, or form, or derogatory, and that is that they become a member of a society, a rare society that we would call the old crone. Are you familiar with that?
Oh, absolutely. And that's the book deals with that a lot. It's up until recently, the popular idea of the roles of women and the way their life is defined was using a model that's called the triple goddess. And that is that a woman's life consists of three periods. The maiden, the young girl, whose job it is basically to figure out who she is. The mother, the nurturing woman who gives life and preserves life on many levels, and the crone. The crone is the older woman past childbearing age who is the purveyor of culture, really. She's the, you know, the archetypal grandma in the rocking chair with her children around her teaching. However, I discovered when I was approaching my own middle years that triumvirate did not speak to me at all, nor to any other woman that I knew in the, you know, the Western developed world.
Mm-hmm.
Because, as you said before, we live typically way into our 80s, more and more 90s, and way more hundreds these days. And so to think that once you can no longer bear children, that you're an old crone is ridiculous. You can't be the wise one for half of your life. So I was missing a stage between the mother and the old lady.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're not. Women in our 50s, women in our 60s are not old. And in a way, I always thought it was disrespectful to think of it, because what do we know that an 85, 90-year-old woman knows? There's a lot of living and knowledge and wisdom that goes on in a matter of 20 and 30 years. So that's what I was missing. And so I kind of deconstructed that idea of the triple goddess and made her a fourfold goddess and inserted another stage of life between being the mother. And when I say mother, I mean the archetypal mother.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to give birth to be a mother. You can give birth to a business or a political interest or an art form. It's about giving birth to something of your passion and keeping it alive, basically. And I realized that there's a time after that childbearing age where women have devoted 20, 25, 30, 35 years of their life to that nurturing that you talked about. Again, whether it's to a family of living children, or if it's a novel, or if it's a career. We've all done our service. And now there's a need for women to see themselves not as old. And, you were right, our culture does not venerate the old. So the minute you stop bleeding monthly, you're discarded and thrown away. And that could be for 50 years of your life. That's obscene.
Mm.
It's obscene anyway.
Certainly.
But so I'm calling that stage the queen, because now in our middle years we have the wisdom of having lived a relatively long time. We've had a lot of experience, but we're not old. We still are energetic. We're still sexual. We're still enthusiastic. And so women in our middle years are really in our highest point of power now. You know, we've climbed the ladder of whatever it is we've been doing with our life. And we're at a stage of responsibility and authority and expertise, and we rule right now.
I like that. We rule.
Exactly. And if more of us felt that empowerment and that sovereignty, we could rule in a truly equal way, and perhaps maybe even in a better way, because the last few millennia haven't really gone all that well in the long run. And I think that more women this year, there are, I believe, 19 women in the Senate, which has never happened before. That's fabulous. But there really should be 52 women in the Senate?
I'm hoping that we can get 90% women in both the Senate and the House. That's what I'd like to see.
Well,
because I'll tell you what, the old boys network ain't working, and we've seen that in the last, especially in the last few months and the last year or two, which is really very disheartening. People talk about wanting to be involved. You should be involved in the system and the process. And it's like, I don't even want to get my hands dirty talking about it.
Exactly.
I mean, that's how some people feel about it.
Exactly.
But
exactly.
What I have noticed is, and I've talked with my mother about this, and she's approaching 80 as well. Both parents are doing quite well, as a matter of fact. But I've noticed she still has a great deal of energy and so forth as she continues, in spite of some of the things that she has dealt with in her life just in the last few years. Their health is good, but again, you know, have those physical challenges, and yet she is still there. She is still there for us as the children and the grandchildren and even a great-grandchild, which is, from my perspective, very exciting, because when my great-grandmother on my mother's side passed away, we were down to three generations living. Now we're back up to four again. And I'm not sure why that's a big deal, but it is to me. But it was a girl. And I've noticed the matriarchal aspects in my own family on my mother's side. Not just as far as, you know, telling us as children what to do, whether it was an aunt or a grandmother or a great-grandmother, but more in terms of being there for us when we were having troubles, when we were having difficulties. And then as I grew older and I started to educate myself about this whole area that you're talking about, that space between the younger female and the older female heading into the senior years, not in the midlife anymore, now in the fall, the winter of the life, if you will, to coin a song lyric, that they had a lot to offer. But I think the sad thing was that we weren't trained and taught and raised to look for that, to seek it out. And I feel like what you're saying is that we as a society, let alone even family members, we really miss, we're missing out on a lot.
Oh, absolutely. And the women were also not prepared to stake that claim.
Exactly. I mean, we weren't ready to seek out the guidance, the wisdom, and the women weren't prepared to dispense it. They didn't know that they had it at their disposal because, again, as you know, they weren't trained to do so. So when we start talking about these kinds of things and trying to, even if we don't even think of it from a social perspective or a society perspective, let's just keep it local. Let's just keep it between you and me here, Donna.
Okay.
How does a woman begin the process of reclaiming that sovereignty in those years, to be there for family and friends and the society and the civilization? It seems to me like they are as integral a part of our society's staying together, the glue, as those who live in the monasteries and spin the prayer wheels around the world are helping to keep the planet together as well.
Oh, absolutely, and that was that's a great comparison. But you did leave out one group, something
mm-hmm.
they are not there for, and that's themselves. You know, we've been I had an original publisher before the publisher that published this book, because I bought back my rights because it was kind of a really ridiculous situation,
mm-hmm.
where he bought the book, but then he panicked and he said, "The queen of myself, isn't that selfish?" And I thought, okay, this is not the right place for me.
Yeah.
You know, so that women have been taught to always put ourselves last,
mm-hmm.
if at all. And so how do we claim that sovereignty is to realize that in order to serve our family, our community, our planet, etc., we need to serve ourselves. And I don't mean being self-serving.
Right.
But I just what you said in the beginning of the program, it is about self-esteem and self-regard, because we can't serve from an empty platter.
You know, share something very briefly with you, and we'll continue on here. And that is, I had a conversation not too long ago with some friends, and we were talking about this whole business of self-worth. And I remember as I grew up in broadcasting, I grew up working for a Christian radio station. I was there for 15 years. And one of the messages, and this was across the board, male and female, one of the messages that I heard early on was that we were lowly worms, that we were, you know, that we just were disgusting, sinful creatures, and on and on and on. And as I began to hear the other messages, especially about redemption and salvation and so forth, and I heard that other message too, I'm going, wait a minute, those two don't go together. That doesn't make any sense to me. There's a passage in the New Testament, and only because I was born and raised Catholic, I use these reference points. If I had been raised Hindu, I might be using reference points from the Gita. But there's a passage in there that says, be perfect, even as your Father in heaven is perfect. Well, what is perfect? And as I began to look at that, and I even looked up the definitions, but even before I looked up the definitions, just logically thinking, I thought, okay, well, it can't have anything to do with right or wrong or good or bad or those duality aspects, because God is none of those things. God is God. And so it has to be perfect even as your Father in heaven is perfect. Well, just be who you are. You're perfect exactly the way that you are, the way that you were created, just as God is perfect exactly the way that he is, using the male construct. And I thought, okay, then the other message doesn't fit, because if we had no value whatsoever in the eyes of the Creator, then what's the point of going through the redemption and salvation rituals, if you will, to save the species, because we're valueless. So I thought, okay, I'm going to dismiss that whole worm theory and say we had to have been of extreme value and importance. We were created and cared for so much that story unfolded of redemption and salvation. And that's what really led me on this path that I've been on for I've lost track of the number of years, over 30, 35, maybe 40 years, that what we're talking about here now, here today with you, Donna Hennis, in regards to your book, The Queen of Myself, is just that we don't have to do anything to acknowledge our value, our importance, our worth to self. We just are, right?
Right. And we, especially as women, I think that a lot of men, maybe not all every man, but certainly the old guard, the old farts who are making so much trouble these days, were raised with an incredible sense of entitlement.
Yes.
And, you know, it's hard to give up power gracefully, and that certainly is not happening. They're kicking and screaming the whole way. But women are not. Women are raised to be nice, to be good, not to make waves, and to take care of everybody. And there's nothing wrong with any of those things. I much prefer nice people than not nice people.
Sure.
But there is a point where women are not allowed or meant to think of themselves, think of their own needs or their own wants or their own desires. It is considered to be selfish.
Mm.
And you know, I collect what I call midlife mantras. It's if I hear, you know, 10,000 women saying the same thing, I know this is a real thing. And one of them is, now it's my turn. You know, you reach a certain age, you've done your service, you've paid your dues. Now it's my turn. Maybe I can get that novel out of the drawer that I started in college, or maybe I can take a ceramics class, or maybe I could go someplace or do something, or to fulfill some part of a dream that wasn't fulfilled. Because during all this time of caregiving, we are not really, for many reasons, sometimes we don't have the time, sometimes we don't have the energy, sometimes we don't have the emotional support, sometimes we don't have the inner courage or esteem. There are a lot of reasons that hold us back, but the fact is that we are held back and we hold ourselves back.
Mm-hmm.
I had a phone call, a certain kind of counseling. I call it the midwife.
Oh, I like that.
And yes, it's a hard transition. It's a really hard transition. And I got a call from one of my clients who lives in Pennsylvania. I'm in New York. And she's calling me on her cell phone from the supermarket, sobbing in the aisles. She had been divorced for quite some time, but she had two teenage kids, and they were both now out of the house. And this was the first time in like 30 years that she had ever asked herself, okay, Karen, what do you want for dinner tonight? She didn't know what to buy.
Oh, wow.
Her whole life was about, this one's allergic to this, this one won't touch this, this one loves this. It never occurred to her to design a meal about what she felt like eating.
Wow.
Isn't that amazing? But that is an incredible metaphor for what a lot of women are going through.
Absolutely. We're going to continue our conversation here with you, Donna, because this is quite intriguing for me, and especially as a boy growing up with five females in the family and only three males, myself, my brother, and my father. And so we kind of lived under the old matriarchal system, whether we liked it or not. So we'll continue talking. I'm Richard Dugan. This is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We're giving you choices and knowledge of those choices through the book, The Queen of Myself, my guest, Donna Hennis. And we want you to stay right where you are. Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Thanks for staying with us as we continue our conversation with the author of The Queen of Myself, Donna Hennis. And the subtitle here on the cover of the book is Stepping into Sovereignty in Midlife. I have to say, Donna, that I, growing up in obviously a male-dominated society, intrinsically was a certain level of ease within the systems, the institutions, and so forth, because I was male. And when I got into the business and the industry that I'm in today and hope to be in for many years, of course, I've interviewed people on this kind of subject before, but only now am I to the point where I can kind of verbalize this, that I actually, at certain points along the way, felt guilty because I had the easy ride in a comparative way to the females. And so I would make it my point. I would actually go out of my way to try to find, and if I could, hire women rather than men. Because number one, what I found was that women were more adept at doing the kinds of tasks that we would do. They understood it quicker. That was one of the things that I was so intrigued by, was that the women that I eventually did hire, they just picked up this stuff like nobody's business. I mean, I thought, oh, this is great. I made the right choice. But it was more initially, as I said, out of a sense of guilt because I had been born male. And that it really wasn't fair that the women didn't get a shot. So I was going to try to go out of my way without violating any federal laws, labor practices. to hire women rather than men. I've hired my share of men as well as women, but nonetheless, that was my leaning. I don't do the hiring anymore, so I don't have to worry about that. But I have to ask you in that regard, it feels a little bit like, in the context of what we're talking, I love what you're saying. I have absolutely great respect for what you're promoting and the fact that we're able to do that here on this program. But I also feel a little bit, because I'm a guy, a little left out.
Well, you know, men go through their own midlife crisis, so that's
yeah, but
know.
I'm not going to go out and buy a Corvette. I'll tell you that right now.
No, nor would I. But I think that you can chalk your feelings up to having been raised in a matriarchal household. You saw women up close. You saw their abilities and their capabilities, and you witnessed being passed over or being denied or whatever because they were women. You saw this, and that made you sensitive. But most people don't see this because it's certainly not in the public media, in the popular media. We don't have a whole lot of wonderful female role models out there. We've got a lot, but we certainly don't have enough to tip the balance.
Right.
And I hats off to your mom.
Well, I also have to say, too, that I also was able to see not only their weaknesses, but also how much stronger they were through them. My oldest sister had asthma growing up. What instrument did she choose to play in high school and college? The French horn. Now, what person in their right mind is going to take up a wind instrument? Of sorts. I know it's brass, but nonetheless, when they have trouble breathing. And she loved it. And I can still hear her practicing and tuning up in their bedroom, even right now. When I was a kid growing up, that's what we heard. And it just became normal. But again, I was able to see the strengths as well as the weaknesses and how they worked through them. They didn't overcome them. My sister still has asthma to this day. But she's a mother. She's a grandmother. She was chosen, from what I heard a couple of years ago, she was chosen first chair in, I believe it was the Scottsdale Symphony Orchestra. Just remarkable. So, I think you're right. I did learn a lot from them, my three other sisters as well. I'm still pretty close with my second oldest sister. We communicate fairly regularly. She's actually told me in no uncertain terms, and it's more with my first wife than my second, that if she does anything to hurt me, that my sister was going to be there to defend me. So that was kind of nice to hear. When we talk about this middle age, midlife, and I'm not going to sit here and split hairs in terms of when does it begin, when does it end, because each person has to make that determination for themselves, each woman. But where can a woman begin? She's listening to this program right now. She really is – what you're saying is really resonating with her. And she doesn't know where to start.
Well, first of all, I love that young women do read this book and come to workshops and so on, because you're never too young to start finding your true power and living your true dream. So I don't like to think of young girls as princesses, because a princess does imply a kind of a frivolity and superficial kind of entitlement. Whereas a queen has a lot of responsibility, you know. But you can, maybe think of them as ladies in waiting. You know, they're building their power, and when they're ready to burst forth, then they will, you know, on whatever their timetable is. But the place to start, I think, is in exactly that place that's been denied, ourself. So I think it's important to get to know yourself. Another thing that I've heard women say a lot is they say, now it's my turn, and with all kinds of excitement, And then they hesitate and they really think, oh, so what was that anyway that I wanted to do? You know, you kind of lose your vision of your life that you had when you were younger. And this is a time to not necessarily reclaim your youthful desires because they might have changed, mm-hmm. but to find your true desire. And the midlife transition is really hard. It's very hard for women because it involves, you know, all kinds of hormonal issues and so on. But it's hard for everybody. Everybody has loss in midlife. It's really defined by loss. We lose our physical, you know, we lose our some of our hearing, some of our vision, some of the elasticity in our skin, some of the pigment in our hair. We all do that.
Mm-hmm.
But we also, I'm glad to hear, knock on wood, that your parents are doing great. But in our middle years is when we begin to see our parents start to slow down or get sick or even die. A lot of times we've reached the glass ceiling in midlife, and that's another kind of loss. There's no future along the same path.
Mm-hmm.
We lose, oh my gosh, we lose our partners a lot.
Yeah.
You know, there's a huge surge in divorce in midlife. And, you know, the TV, you know, cry, sob movies would tell you that it's the male midlife crisis. And he buys a Corvette and he runs off with somebody who is always blonde and young and skinny. And, you know, they kind of stop off at the drugstore for him to fill his Viagra prescription and drive off into the happy sunset where he has a whole second family.
Right.
But that doesn't happen all that often, really. Most midlife divorces are instigated by the woman and not because of infidelity and not even because they had a huge knockdown, you know, fight,
mm-hmm.
but because they wake up one morning and they just go, I've done this. I'm done.
Yeah.
I have no idea what it's like to live my own life, and I want to try. And that really is a very, very common story. But so, you know, we often lose our partners. And I think that the thing that we lose that's the most important, that really defines midlife, is that we lose our childish idea that we're invincible or that we are, you know, going to live forever. And when you lose your sense of immortality, see an end. And blessings to all. I hope it's 150 years for everybody.
Yeah.
But there will at some point be an end. And we know that now. And we see it around us as our friends and colleagues start to get sick and die.
Yeah.
And so that's why things become so important to us now. It's like it's now or never, or if not now, when, you know, however you want to say it.
Mm-hmm.
This is the time to start fulfilling some of our own desires and dreams and talents and capabilities. And because we live so long, we do have time for a second career or a third career or a hobby or an art form that we've been wanting to spend time on that we haven't had time. And so I think that that is the big thing of midlife. And so the crisis, I think, a lot of times for men is just that they're scared of getting older. And for women, I think it's more about being scared of being of dying unfulfilled, never knowing who you could have been or what it would be like to make your own decisions.
It kind of goes to the subject of leaving a legacy. What are we going to leave behind?
That too,
yeah. That's part of it as well. So you've talked an awful lot about the things that, as we enter midlife and work our way towards the end of that phase in our lives, and again, each person makes that determination as to the time frame. But can you tell us, what are some of the things that we gain?
Oh, excellent. Oh, I'm so glad you asked that. Because our culture would have women believe that as we age, we lose our sex appeal, any kind of appeal. Women start to feel invisible as they age. And we're all, you know, we've also lost our childbearing capability. So we have no function any longer for the two things that women in our culture are valued for. And so every magazine and movie and so on is telling us that we have everything to lose. And Gallup did a poll of women 55 years and older and asked them which decade was the best for them, when were they the happiest. And, you know, I don't remember the exact numbers, but something like 14% said their 20s, you know, less than 20% said all the decades. The majority, the vast majority of women said right now. And so that's very interesting. Here, supposedly, we've lost everything that's worthwhile about us, and we've never been happier. So what have we gained? We have gained that sense of self with a capital S. We've figured out, or at least we're in the process of figuring out and value the process of figuring out who we are, what we want, what we're good at, what we're interested in, and how we want to spend the rest of our life.
Certainly that that's a big thing in terms of making that kind of an evaluation. I've never believed in a wasted time. I mean, I've had a few other jobs outside of radio and broadcasting. And even though they didn't exactly fit, you know, the model of what I was doing or wanted to do, there was something there that I was able to take forward to the next level, to whatever it was that I was going to do next. And I think that a lot of people might feel that, oh my gosh, I spent, you know, what, 30 or 40 years doing this thing, and I got to go out and I got to figure out what it is that I want to do next in terms of that. And it could be something totally different, but that doesn't mean that the things that you learned in that first career, if you will, won't apply in the second one and won't apply in the third one, if you should choose to have a third one, if you feel you have that much time. It'd be kind of wonderful. But I'm wondering, too, about the money aspect. A lot of people are becoming very they're becoming very frustrated over the pursuit of money as the goal in career, in life's purpose.
Right.
There's even a book, I'm going to be interviewing the author of a book on how to basically bring about, how to effortlessly bring about money. And one of the first questions that I planned to ask him is, how does this correlate with any kind of a true spiritual life and life purpose?
Right.
Because that sounds to me like the old paradigm. But let's talk a little bit about that in the context of here we are midlife, and maybe we have or haven't made all of the money that we could. I've actually met people, I've worked with them, and they've gone through millions and lost it all, and gone through another millions later on and lost it all. I mean, they've done it two or three times, and now it doesn't mean anything to them, you know. They're just having a good time. The ride is just a lot of fun for them.
Right.
And yet the rest of us, we're still struggling, wanting to, I'd like to have the first million, please, you know. So let's talk a little bit about that, because I know that that is a big driver for a lot of people, even in midlife.
Well, I think the big concern about money in midlife is looking ahead 50 years or 40 years or 30 years and thinking, you know what, I really don't want to eat cat food. But other than that, I think that our values really start to change. I feel like in our 30s, you know, maybe late 20s, early 40s, we have an urge to merge, you know, to have a family, to have a partner, to have a community, to have something that we're a part of. And in midlife, I think that one of the indicators is that we have an urge to purge. A lot of people downsize. A lot of people think, what do I have all this stuff for? And do I want to spend the rest of my life polishing silver? Is this really what I want? You know, I spend more time taking care of my stuff than anything. And we start reevaluating what's really important to us. I've heard so many incredible stories about what next. And I agree with what you said. I don't think any knowledge, any experience is ever wasted. And even if it's not applicable to what you want to do next, it gives you an insight to other people and other situations and other ways of thinking and working and so on. It makes you more expansive. It makes you more empathetic. There's no such thing as wasted knowledge, I don't think. And people, I think I'm going in two directions at once here, so I'm confusing myself. But I've heard these really inspiring stories about how money isn't it doing it for me anymore kind of thing. I've done a lot of workshops around the country and been in a lot of different geographic areas and with a lot of women in different socioeconomic situations. And some of the stories are incredible. This one woman was a real corporate big shot in a time where there were so few women in the higher echelons. I mean, she was making, who knows, $400,000 a year easily. And she felt that in terms of wanting to be a more balanced human being, she felt she was living totally out of her mind and her physical stamina. But she had no emotional life. And in corporate world, you're not allowed to have emotions. And no spiritual life. She quit her job and got a job as an assistant in a daycare center, which I don't think is even minimum wage. Of course, she was lucky she didn't have to worry about that, because I'm sure she must have had something going on for her, you know, to back her up. But she was suddenly happy. She loved play. She was like a pig in the mud. She loved these little kids. She said, oh, it's just like little puppies. We have so much fun. She was finding the part of herself that she felt that she had sacrificed to make all that money. Mm. And I've heard lots of other stories like this. One woman, I think she was in Buffalo, she described her life as, you know, the Hollywood version of the perfect life. You know, she lived in a big house and her husband supported her. She didn't work. They belonged to a country club. Their kids were in Ivy League schools, et cetera, et cetera. She divorced her husband, and when I met her, she was living in a one-room, six-floor walk-up studio apartment in Buffalo, New York. And again, she's never been happier. She says she wakes up every morning and says, okay, what are we going to do today, you know? Mm. And so you can't buy freedom, and you can't buy certain kinds of emotional satisfaction. And there are all kinds of ways. I actually have a friend who is a well-known sculptor. She's had exhibits in museums all over the world. And when she reached her 50s, she thought, okay, this is great, but is this it for the rest of my life? You know, one more opening, one more plastic glass of bad wine. I mean, is this my whole future? And she's still an artist, but she's not in that hustle part of being an artist. She's still a creative person. But she went to China and adopted a baby and fulfilled, again, her need for connection and family and nurturing and so on, which she wasn't really fulfilling in what she was doing, even though it gave her a certain amount of fame, a certain amount of stability. I don't think she was ever rich, but it certainly satisfied all her needs. So, I mean, there are what was this saying, 6 million stories in the naked city? You know, I've heard so many stories like that. And it just, you know, moving to a trailer and just having, you know, living out of a suitcase. And it's, you know, and if that's the kind of person you are, and if that is satisfying to you and untangles a lot of the pressure and stress in your life, then go for it. And if what you want is money, then go for that. I mean, I'm not passing a judgment here, but I do know that money does not make you happy.
Well, you know, it's interesting how you mentioned something that I thought was rather interesting. There was a movie that I watched, and I'm trying to remember the title of it. It starred Albert Brooks, and it went back to like the, I don't know, I guess the 80s, maybe early 90s. And Lost in America, that was the name of it.
Huh.
I don't know if you've seen it.
I don't think I have.
But these folks are actually in their 30s, maybe early 40s, but I'm going to say 30s. And he works for an ad agency. I can't even remember what company she works for. And she's doing well, and she was just promoted. He was hoping to get promoted, but instead is being asked to move to New York. They have sufficient assets that if they sold the house, they rolled over their 401ks, they did all of this stuff, they would have enough money to buy a travel trailer, like a Winnebago.
Right.
And travel the country and just see what's out there. They could do that on that income for maybe that nest egg for maybe a year or two or three. I mean, how could you go through over $100,000 even in that day in less than that? I mean,
right.
You'd really have to be going crazy. Well, what happens is they decide they're going to get remarried. They're already married, and they're going to get remarried where? Las Vegas, where she has a little bit of a gambling problem. And off goes the nest egg, about $800 they had left over. And so they end up pulling the trailer into a small town called Safford, Arizona. I believe that was the name of it, into an RV park. And they have to get jobs. And they're going through this process where, yeah, it was a nice experience, but you know what? We got enough money. Let's just go to New York. I'll take the job, and then we'll go from there. I mean, and so they're driving cross country, going through the South and then going up the East Coast. And it's just a very interesting, because it's one of the things that my wife and I sort of dream about. I could, because of technology, I could do this on the road.
Right.
What you and I are doing, I could do on the road. As a matter of fact, I prefer it because I would be able to visit face to face with people. And interview them and talk with them and share their stories on this program, on the website. And so it's like, what a neat idea. And you have your home and your room and your board right there with you. I mean, and, you know, and so, I mean, I'm in my early 50s. And I am, you know, I'm almost halfway. I'll be 54 in June. I'm already thinking this way, but people say, well, you know, when are you planning on retiring? I'm saying the only retiring I'm going to be doing is if my car needs them.
Exactly.
Okay. There's an interesting picture that was sent to me after one of these extended baseball games that really went extra innings. A friend of mine sent me this picture of this skeleton draped over a broadcast console. And he captioned it with the announcer at the stadium saying, okay, we're going into the 18th inning, and I really want to thank Richard Dugan for staying with us and going through the broadcast with us and so on and so forth, you know. Great job. And there's this skeleton draped up. And I tell people, I said, that's the only way that I'm ever going to end this career. They're going to have to peel my dead cold carcass off of the console. Not too many people that I know of have been lucky enough to have found their life's purpose in that regard. And that's not to say there aren't other things that I would like to do, but this has certainly been unbelievable. So when somebody in that phase of midlife is listening to this, male or female for that matter, are there any signs that you can guide them to that would help them to start to look at that? I mean, we've talked about life's purpose on this program, I don't know how many countless numbers of times, but everybody has a different way of approaching how they get in touch with that life purpose. What's yours?
Well, I have a lot, and actually the book has a lot of suggestions in it to how to find yours. But and these are all things that we've all heard of but don't do, and that is to keep a journal and write about it. And I'm not talking about a dear diary, today I went here and I ate this, but talk to yourself in writing, because it's amazing what comes out of that pen that you don't realize what you're thinking or saying. Meditating is good. Picking up, you know, being a teenager again, trying things out, trying new things out. Well, I like this. No, don't like that. Oh, this is interesting. Maybe I'll take a course in this. I like this. This is cool. Just really testing the world, seeing what's out there, as you say, doing things you've never done before. And that's exactly how a kid discovers what they like and what they don't like and what they're good at and what appeals to them. I think what to go back to what you were talking about before in terms of maybe wasted time or doing things that you didn't want to do, and then how do you get back on your path and so on. I think it's really important to understand that we each have a path, and we're on that path. But every path is not like a jet runway, you know, that you have this perfectly smooth and vertical ascent. Some paths are circuitous, and some are detours, and some are cul-de-sacs, and some are have litter, and some have roadkill. But you never know when you turn that next left turn what miracle you're going to come into. And that's maybe about faith in terms of following your path and knowing that nothing is wasted, no experience is wasted, no everything leads you to something else if you're open to that. But there are all other kinds of ways too, and this is for men and women. Everything in here, obviously except for menopause, can easily be understood and used by men. One other way is about, you know, I divided it into four parts, you know, getting to know yourself, your mental self, your thoughts, your ideas, your capabilities, your emotions, getting to know your emotions, getting to and finding a way to serve yourself on a physical level. One suggestion is actually to make yourself a meal, the perfect meal that you would like to eat, and eat it, serve yourself on it with a tablecloth and the good dishes, and don't stand at the refrigerator at the stove eating out of the pot, but to treat yourself like a valued guest, to start doing things that honor yourself. Bless yourself is a big one for me, major one. I think it's crucial that we bless ourselves, because the more we bless ourselves, the more we believe it. And the more you believe it, the more you embody it and you project it. And the more you project it, the more you get it right back at you. And so that's something I always encourage people to do, is to bless themselves every day. You can bless yourself with what you need, with what you feel like you want to call to you. I bless myself with courage or with healing or with confidence or with peace of mind or less stress or whatever it is that you want. But I think it's also great, and a little harder for a lot of people to do, is to bless yourself for what you like about yourself. Bless your good points. acknowledge your good points. You know, I bless myself because I'm a kind person, and I do random acts of kindness. I bless myself because I tithe to charities, or because I, you know, helped find a home for this little lost dog, or, you know, whatever. But to bless yourself with how good you are, how honorable you are, how far you've come, how much you've learned, how much you know that you didn't used to know. And that is a huge esteem builder. And it's gradual, but if you keep doing that, it's amazing. It's really amazing how your whole perspective on who you are and what your worth is, as well as that of other people, really changes and expands. So those are some of the things. One of the suggestions is to take yourself out on a date by yourself. Get dressed up, take yourself where you've always wanted to go and somehow could never find anybody to go with you. Treat yourself to whatever it is, a play, a museum, a walk in the park, a great hike, whatever you consider to be an ideal date, do it. You know, it's really about paying attention to ourselves in the same way that we pay attention to other people we love.
Go ahead and continue.
Well, I think I finished, actually.
Okay. Tell me about how grace and gratitude factor into all of this.
Oh, it's crucial, I think. I just had a big weekend of talking and dealing with grace and gratitude. It's Thanksgiving, and I take that very seriously, very literally, in terms of counting my blessings and giving thanks and trying to share the bounty. And I think it's absolutely crucial, because what happens sometimes is when things aren't going the way we want them to go, if we've had a disappointment at work, in our family relations, in our own spiritual or social development, if we're upset with ourselves and we're not feeling good about ourselves, our tendency is to feel sorry for ourselves. And I feel like the perfect prescription for that is perspective. It's like, oh, I don't have enough money, I don't have any money, and I don't care who you are, if you're living here, even the people who are up against the wall right now, and there are a lot of them, still, compared to 90-95% of the people on the planet, we are so lucky. Poverty in America is a horrible thing, because we spend all of our resources on killing and not on living and healing and feeding and nurturing and educating. The resources are there if they were allocated. But poverty other places can mean, you know, working for 18 hours to find a handful of rice to try to feed 8 people on. And I feel like that brings you right back to feeling positive about your own life. As hard as it is, how could you feel bad when you realize how hard some people's life is, and especially when you realize how hard some, if not most, people's lives are, and they are graceful, and they don't spend their whole time feeling sorry for themselves, but trying to make it better. I think that's just crucial for any person at any stage of our life, is to see our life in perspective. It's really important.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. I have to say that this has just been extraordinary, this conversation that we've had here on the program today, and I thank you so much for taking the time. I have just a few more questions for you before we wrap up the program. Who is Donna Hennis?
I am, by profession, I am a shaman and a ritualist. I'm a writer. I've written, published 3 other books, and I write for the Huffington Post and BeliefNet and UPI, Religion and Spirituality Forum, and so on. My whole life actually is based on celebration, transformation, and empowerment. I'm really keen on personal empowerment and personal responsibility. And I always spell responsibility with a hyphen, to be able to respond. I guess that's who I am. I think I'm a happy person. I've worked a long time to create my own version of a wonderful life, and it might not be for everybody, but it is for me, and I'm very grateful for that. So I'm not sure how else you meant that, but I feel like I live by my gut. Mm-hmm. And I'm sustained through a spiritual sense of connection to the big picture on every level, you know, to all that is.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you're doing now?
Well, I always think of myself as a connecting force processor. I think my goals are, and everything that I do fits into these categories one way or another, mm-hmm. is I really want to be a facilitator for connection, for people connecting with each other in a ritual setting that is temporary but profound. People connecting to the universe, to the cosmos, to the big picture, to other people, to different kinds of people, to promote the feeling of the family of humanity, if you will, and to also facilitate through my writing, and also I do for a long time I've been doing spiritual counseling, to facilitate a connection that each person can have with their own deepest, best self, and to act from that center. So I think those are my goals. I'd like to make the world a better place in some way. I've always really had idols and role models who do that. Even as a little girl, my idol in life was Albert Schweitzer, which I find kind of funny and endearing looking back at it, because I'm sure most other little girls never even heard of him. But, you know, it's like, I don't know where I was, but I was out there somewhere. But yes, that's always been my goal on some level.
And how powerful are we as human beings?
Infinitely powerful.
Male or female?
Well, of course. and ultimately, in the big picture, I'm not sure there's such a difference. In the small picture of the world, the globe that we live in, there's a huge difference, and it's an imbalance, and it's a dangerous one. I often think that our planet is suffering from testosterone poisoning.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, not just Mother Earth herself, but all of the living creatures on this planet are suffering right now from a kind of a male hubris. But I think that on a soul level, that we are powerful, and you know, our most contemporary quantum physics talks about that we live in a participatory universe, and that every thought that we think or don't think affects so much around us, that energy goes where we send it. How much more powerful can we be to really be able to send our energy into the world to create our intentions and our goals? And I don't mean necessarily our financial goals, although you can apply it to that, but I think it's on a bigger level and a deeper level, to know that we have a lot of effect, and we can really, really change things, starting with ourselves, starting with our thoughts, starting with our intentions, starting with our how we deal with our emotions, how we deal with each other. I mean, there's so much that we have power over. We don't have power over situations. Things happen. Mm-hmm. This is a big universe, and it's not all about us.
Yeah.
So we don't really have control about most things that happen, but we have infinite control of how we deal with it. Mm. And that's what changes things.
Donna Hannes, I want to thank you so much for joining us on the program and sharing with us The Queen of Myself. And you put a .com on that, and boom, you are at her website, thequeenofmyself.com. She has several others, donnahennes.net. And she also has Tree of Life. It looks like funerals, yes. Which is a whole nother subject that we could get into, because transitioning is a subject that I'm always hesitant to say is near and dear to my heart, but it's something that is very intriguing to me. And you also have another website called Mama Donna's Donna Spirit Shop.com. And that is where we certainly, any one of these websites, I'm sure, will take us to where we can get a copy of The Queen of Myself. Donna Hennes, thank you again for joining us.
Thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure.
I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love to all.